this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, June 21st, 2009, and this is show number 210. I'd like to give a Father's Day shout-out to all the fathers out there, especially at SP Sheridan. We had a lot of fun yesterday, went out for some sushi with my mom and my kids and him, and we had a great time. But tonight he's hard at work making me some steaks, as he should on Sunday nights, you know. Got to get him working, you know. Can't pamper him too much. Anyway, I hope all of you are getting to do whatever you want today, even if that means lying on the couch watching baseball and eating Cheetos. It's your day. You should enjoy it. Well, hey, let's see. Mac Roundtable number 65 should be out by the time you hear this. I hope it was 65. Anyway, the new Mac Roundtable is going to be out, so tune in there if you want to hear my impressions of iPhone 3.0 and the new iPhone 3GS. Kyle and I both got them, and I figured I shouldn't bore you here because I'm going to bore you over there. No, I mean, it's exciting, of course, hearing me talk about it, but it would be really boring if I said it both places. So we'll just skip right on over the iPhone stuff for here, and go on over and check out the Mac Roundtable. We had a great show with Bart and Don and I, so tune in, and that way you won't be bored hearing it twice. Let's see. I know all the excitement about Bing is settled down, but I wanted to give you a quick note about a site that lets you compare the results from Bing to Google all in one place. They call the site Bingle. Get it? Bing, Google, Bingle. It's kind of cute. But it's not at bingle.com. It's at bingle.ponage.com, and Ponage is spelled P-W-N-I-J.com. It's kind of a fun site because they show you two parallel windows side by side with Bing on the left, Google on the right, and you can really tell which one does a better job. I've used it a bunch of times, and I find it really interesting because Bing actually does better on some things and Google does better on others. Say, for example, I still prefer Bing's photo and video discovery, but Google appears much more forgiving of my typos. Anyway, go check out Bingle and see for yourself. Maybe it's the best of both worlds. Keep them both open.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Well, last week I told you that I got a ton of dumb questions and I didn't have time to answer any of them, so I'm going to have to take a crack at a whole bunch of them that I got last week. Pierre Bourgeois asked me what seemed to be the toughest question. Here's what he said. With the release of Snow Leopard, there's a lot of talk about 64-bit versus 32-bit. Does one's ability to benefit from this depend on the hardware that we have running? I have fairly recent Macs, all Intel-based. Does that mean that I will be able to benefit from the 64-bit architecture? Well, I say that that seemed like the toughest question because there's so many intricacies of the whole 32-64-bit question. I went over it with Bart, and the good news is we found a really simple answer to this one. Yes, the simple answer is to go to MacFixit and read what they wrote on the subject. See, I'm cheating. But they have a lovely description of all the intricacies, not just of the 64-bit question, but the whole CL graphics issue, too. Shoot, I just barely got in the hang of Quartz graphics. Now I got to start over. Anyway, head on over to the link in the show notes to MacFixit.com for the real scoop on this. It's a real long URL, so just hit the link over on the website. See, that was easy peasy. Wasn't a dumb question at all. Well, let's see. Next up, Greg Norton felt really bad that I'd been so neglected in the dumb question corner that he actually sent in three questions. The bad news is that I didn't know the answer to any of them off the top of my head, so I had to dig a bit and do some research. I like his questions because while finding the answers was kind of tough, they seem like easy questions, something that you should know the answer to right off the top of your head. Well, I'll quit teasing and get started with his dumb questions. Dumb question number one. I got a 15-inch MacBook Pro right before the unibody versions came out last fall. Got a great deal, and what a great laptop. At home, I use that machine wirelessly and enjoy the effortless way the two computers network together. Lately, I've noticed that when I open the Finder to navigate between the machine's drives, little numbers appear in parentheses after their names. There's not an obvious logic to this numbering, and it seems to vary from time to time. Is this normal? I don't remember it happening at first, and if so, what do these numbers mean? Well, I had to ask Greg to send me a screen snapshot of this because I wasn't sure what he was talking about, and I was pretty sure he must just be confused. But if you look at the snapshot in the show notes, you'll see it's exactly what he says. The machine he's on is called Greg and Paul's iMac, but it has a 3 in parentheses after the name. In the shared list, you can see his MacBook, but after its name, it has a 4 in parentheses. Even though this seems a unique problem, I think it fits the dumb question objective here, because if you were new to the Mac, you might think this meant something or was to be expected in some way. Was hard to figure out exactly how to search for that, but I did eventually find a whole bunch of people with the same weirdness in the Apple discussion forums. Several people were speculating that it was if you'd ever had the same name on two different machines, but of course, that many people wouldn't have done such an odd thing. The final conclusion was that it's actually a bug that weaseled in during a recent OS X update. The good news is one poster offered a solution. Peter Van Doorn said, just go to the system preferences on the offending Mac, select the sharing preferences, then turn off file sharing if it's on. Then you can rename the Mac in the field at the top. Finally, turn file sharing back on if you need to. I'll be curious if the numbers stay gone for Greg forever if he tries that. Be sure to let us know how well that works, Greg. Dumb question number 2 from Greg. Another wireless network question. On my iMac, I have a wireless router and printer hooked up to the iMac, and they're in our home office, which is separate from the house. Sometimes when I'm working wirelessly on the MacBook Pro, I want to print something, but that only works if the iMac is awake, and it usually isn't unless someone's in the office using it. Is there a way to awaken the iMac without going out to the office and manually hitting a key? Can I bypass the iMac and communicate directly with the printer somehow, hopefully without buying more hardware? I would hate to have the iMac always awake just for the odd times when this problem comes up. Well, it turns out that I actually have a clue about this one. I know that what you're asking for is called wake on LAN, where LAN means local area network. So you're trying to wake up something that's on the LAN. And so if your home office iMac happens to be hardwired via Ethernet to the router, not wireless itself, the iMac, you can absolutely wake your machine over the network. The lovely people over at readpixel.com have written a free Mac application called, of all things, Wake on LAN. These folks know how to write software. You open the app, and you'll see a list of all the computers on your network that are hardwired. And that works even if you're wireless on the laptop. It's just the machine you want to wake up has to be hardwired. You select the computer to be awakened. That's it. Okay, that's not easy enough for you. How about a dashboard widget from the same people at readpixel.com? Click the machine you want to wake up and click wake. Now, I have one question for people with this same request. Don't you have to go into the room where the printer is to get the papers anyway? Couldn't you just wake it up when you walk in there? I mean, I suppose you have to carry the laptop in there, but maybe that's easier. I do know I had the same problem until I got a wireless router from Apple, and now I've got it. I've actually got the printer hooked directly up to it, so I never have to wake up the Mac that's in there. And plus, I don't have a Mac in here to drive it anyway, so it works out pretty well for me. All right, that's 2 down. Here comes number 3. You often mention the need for us former Windows users to learn to use the Command Q to close programs. Point well taken. But is there a keyboard shortcut for closing multiple applications at once? Maybe even one for closing all of them at once. I find that printers and Acrobat in particular are almost always hanging around in my dock long after their business is over and done. Well, this was the hardest one. I took one look at it and I figured, there's no way to do that. But then a quick Bing search. Yes, I used Bing. Quit mocking me. Anyway, Bing gave me a list of applications to do this very thing. One of them is called Quit Anything from Frozen Head Software. You gotta love the name of that place. And the developer explained that it's using the Unix kill all command via a menu item. Well, of course Unix would have a way to do this. Here's what the developer says about their application. Quit Anything is a simple application that can be used to quit processes. It lets you quit multiple processes all at once without having to switch to each one, and also lets you quit background processes, aka faceless background apps or daemons. Please note that there are many system processes which run under OS X which cannot be seen by AppleScript, and so this program can't actually quit anything, as the name suggests. Hey, the name was accurate when it was first created. I love it. I gave Quit Anything a try, and it was pretty interesting. It came up with a window with about 30 running processes. Now I see what the warning message in the README file was talking about. It said, warning, Quitting an essential background process may have unwanted side effects. I don't recommend quitting specialized system processes unless you have a full understanding of what the result of doing so will be. Well, I looked at my gigantor list of 30 applications, many of which are, you know, obvious applications I'm running, but there's also some things I don't know a darn thing about, like MD Worker. But what amazes me is how many gloppy things I've actually caused in my OS myself, like Flipshare, Autorun, Google Updater Helper, Growl Helper, iDrive Daemon, Media Central Launcher. I could go on and on. I tried iDrive, gosh, like a year ago, and it's got to be at least 2 years since Media Central was ever intentionally run. I really do need to do a cleanup, stop moving my entire user account over when I get a new machine. That's out of control. Anyway, back to Greg's question. You can hit select all and just hit quit selected, and everything goes away. I was too chicken to do that, but I'll let you try it, Greg, and you let us know how it works. I almost forgot to mention that Quit Anything is freeware, but the developer helpfully suggests that you could click that PayPal button if you like the software. They have a bunch more tools over at frozenheads.com, so go over there and check it out. Well, now, I got intrigued with this category, and I thought, I wonder if that's the only application that does it. So I kept looking, and I found another application that achieves the same objective. It's called Quits Apps from limit-point.com. Here's the description from the developer. Quits Apps is a utility for quitting groups of applications. You can either use quit flags to mark a collection of applications for immediate termination, or create a schedule for quitting applications at different times. Subsequently, you can relaunch the last set of terminated applications. Quits Apps shows the icons and names of all the running applications, how long they've been up, and the location of the application file. Now that's really cool. How many times have you been hunting around trying to figure out if an app is a real application or maybe it's a preference pane or some mutant kind of application? Down across the bottom of the window, you can select all, deselect all, or even select a few and then invert your selection. So let's say you want to make sure a couple of those weird critical files that you don't understand are still running. You could select those, then hit invert selection and quit everything else. That sounds fun. Like I said, these applications are using a Unix command under the hood, which is called kill all. That's a dangerous command in the hands of someone like me who is not careful at all, but it feels much safer with a GUI where you can see what you're killing. Things like user event agent. Sounds like that might be important, so I won't kill that one. Anyway, you can even set a time for your applications to quit using Quits Apps. I have no clue why you'd need to do that, but if you could think of a reason, Quits Apps has that capability. I suppose maybe you could say I go to bed at 10 o'clock every night, quit all my unused applications so you can launch them one at a time when you get back. I don't know. They've also got a menu bar application for Quits Apps, so if you're like Tim Verporten and you'd like that feature, Quits Apps is from Limit Point Software, and they have an interesting business model. If you make a donation, and they have handy little buttons for $10, $15, $20, and $25, you get unlocked versions of all of their 55-plus utilities. Don't you think $20 or something like that for 55-plus utilities sounds pretty good? I think so. Check out the full list over at limit-point.com. Well, I'm pretty sure if I kept searching, I'd find even more of these application quitting utilities, but you get the gist now, Greg. You can quit all of your applications with an easy utility, not a keystroke like you asked for, but it looks like there is an easy way to do it. Thanks for all the great questions. I learned a ton doing the research for your questions. Well, we're not done with dumb questions yet, but let's take a break before we head into our next dumb question with a quick word about screen steps. I got to tell you, I don't know what Trevor and Greg are thinking. They keep adding these amazing new capabilities to screen steps, and they're not charging upgrade fees. As long as it's in the 2-point family, they keep giving it to us for free. Now, they promised me that they're going to charge a fee when they go up to 3.0, but for now, you just keep getting all these more screen steps goodness with your original purchase. Maybe I should explain really quick what screen steps is for the new listeners in the crowd. Screen Steps is an amazing documentation tool that makes it easy and actually enjoyable to take screen snapshots, annotate them with text, add boxes, arrows, and even sequence numbers, and then write up the text of your lesson, all without ever worrying about the formatting. Screen Steps does all of the heavy lifting for you. The real magic is when you're done writing and putting in the images, and you have so many options now to push out your documentation. You can still send it to HTML or PDF, which they've had for ages, or you can send it straight to WordPress or TypePad, Confluence Wiki, MindTouch, and Movable Type. And now, if you're a pro user, you can even send your lessons and manuals to Microsoft Word, OpenOffice, Apple's Pages, any one of those tools that supports, what's that new OpenDoc format? Or, I might have messed that up, but it's the one that they all do. Anyway, is that enough applications for you? How many of you wish you could put video in your lessons on ScreenSteps? Yeah, now ScreenSteps lets you embed video from other sites like YouTube or Vidler right into your lesson. All you do is enter the embed code and it's in your lesson. How cool is that? I just downloaded ScreenSteps 2.6. I can't wait to give that a try. If you'd like to own ScreenSteps yourself to make your workflow easy and fun, download the free 30-day trial from ScreenSteps.com. When you're ready to buy, don't forget to use the coupon code NOCILLA, that's my name spelled backwards with all capital letters, to get 25% off of your purchase price of ScreenSteps. Trust me, you'll be really happy if you do. Well, we're back with another dumb question, this time from Ken Zuckerman. He asked, I have a dumb question. I like to keep my desktop icons organized in a particular way. Whenever I plug my iMac into my LCD TV to view a movie, the resolution changes and the icons move around. When I unplug and reset my screen resolution, the icons are all over the place, destroying my careful work of keeping them in their proper places. How can I keep this from happening? Love your show, Ken. Well, Ken, I'm so glad you love the show. That's so nice of you to say. I'm going to throw this one out to the crowd to see if they have a better idea, but I do have some ideas of my own. The first one seems kind of obvious, but if you don't know it's there, you wouldn't know to do it. If you right-click on the desktop, you'll get an option to see a menu towards the bottom that says Keep Arranged By. If you pull over on that, it turns out you can arrange by name, date modified, date created, size, kind, or label. So you can choose one of those stock options, and it should stay the same no matter what you do. Unplugging and plugging that monitor in should not mess that up. Now you have to be willing to go with one of those stock options. So let's say that's not going to meet your need for some reason. I really should ask you why you have things on the desktop in the first place. I use other methods to get to the same items every day that might give you what you're looking for, even if I'm not answering the question quite the way you wanted to do it. For example, I keep an Excel file that I launch every day dragged into the left sidebar of my Finder window. Once you drag it into one Finder window, it's in every Finder window. So now, with a single click, I can open it, enter the data I need to enter, and quit. You can order the sidebar items any way you want, and they always stay in place. They're not alphabetical or anything like that. Turns out you can drag in files, applications, even Apple scripts. I have two Apple scripts in my sidebar. The one Will created for me to start a new podcast episode every week, and the one Steve Harris of Reinvented Software created to let me save my feeder files out as HTML. Both of them are right there from any open Finder window, which is actually easier than getting to the desktop most days for me. Another method to organize things and have them very, very accessible is to drag them to the top of a Finder window. For example, I keep app delete from ReggieAshworth.com in the top of my Finder window so that anytime I can drag applications right to it without having to mess around opening two windows, you know, one showing the soon-to-meet-its-demise application and the other one showing app delete itself. I just drag it right to the top of the Finder window and boom, it's deleted. I guess what I'm trying to do here is, since I don't know the answer to the question you did ask, I figured I'd change the question to what I do know how to answer. And the question maybe should really be, how do I manage a Mac so that I have easy and consistent access in one location that stays put to files, applications, utilities, and Apple scripts? I hope that's the question that you meant to ask, because that's the one I knew the answer to. I sure hope that helps you out, Ken. So remember when I did a big old review of the two applications that Gita recommended for more easily moving and sizing OS X windows? One of them was called Zoom 2, Z-O-O-O-M, three O's, Z-O-O-O-M. And I got to tell you, I am still loving it. The main thing I use constantly is holding down the Command-Shift keys, and then I can click on any window anywhere in the window and just drag it around. I love that feature. When I'm on another Mac or a PC, it drives me crazy that I can't use it. Way back when I did that show about Zoom, I said Zoom does one thing and does it well. It turns out I was wrong about that. Not that it does its job well, but that it does one thing well. John from Code Rage Software sent me an email where he told me about some other cool stuff it can do. The first one is an adjustment to how you can move windows around. Like I said, Command-Shift and then click on a window to drag works great. But if you turn off Click to Activate, which is a feature that's on by default, you can start moving a window that's not even in front. You haven't even clicked on it. You don't have to click and then select it to move. You just click and drag right in one shot. I was really, really excited about that. So that works great. While I was playing around with Zoom, I just sort of accidentally double-clicked a window while I was holding down the Zoom keys, and it went full screen. This is spectacular. One of my big problems of sliding between Windows and the Mac is that I get used to double-clicking the top bar to go full screen on a window. But if I do it on the Mac, that hides the window, which is the exact opposite of what I want. It drives me crazy every time I do that. This hidden gem in Zoom is a great addition. Well, after I discovered this all on my lonesome, I read the next line of John's email where he told me about double-clicking. Okay, I could have read, but I discovered it, so it was more fun. Anyway, he did point out that it actually does what the green button does, not a full-size window. He mentioned that maybe that could be a new feature for the next version, and I think it should be. I hate it when the green button doesn't go full-size. I mean, what's a green button for if not for full-size? Some size the developer thought would be groovy? Should be full size. It's the only two options, whatever it is and something else, not just random sizes. Anyway, finally, John told me about the magnetics option. That allows you to snap to the edges of other windows when you're dragging or changing the size on them. You can make windows align really, really easily, pixel accurate, he said. He suggested I just explore the magnetics tab a little to find some of these little gems. Ooh, he used the same phrase I used. Anyway, you can choose what gets to be magnetic, things like visible window edges, the edges of the display, the top menu bar, and the dock. You can even choose when they're magnetic. Maybe you only want it to be magnetic during moves, but not during resizing, or you want it during both. Magnetics makes it really easy to align windows and get them all the way to the edge so you don't waste any space on your screen. I love it. Go check out Zoom one more time. It's only $14.95. From CodeRage-Software.com. I think it's totally worth the money. Well, it's time for another testimonial from one of Honda Bob's loyal customers. Well, now I've cornered Don Lawton, who it looks like might know Honda Bob longer than anybody else. Where did you say you met him, Don?
I met him when he was working at From Pontiac Honda, and that would have been 1971.
Okay, Bob's arguing from the corner that it's 74, so we might have to have a smackdown on this.
Hey, when you get to be my age.
You're lucky you remember the 70s at all, huh? Do you have any stories to tell us about Bob we might not already know? Strange things he's done to you?
He's never done anything strange to me, but he somehow manages to run a mobile service and keep a fairly decent schedule and get the cars done on time. And that's one of those things where customer calls up and says it's going clunk, clunk, clink, clink, and you get out there and you find it's going rattle, rattle, clunk, clunk, and it's an entirely different problem, which means whatever your preparations were are now down the tubes, and you've got to start over. So if you can keep a schedule working within that kind of a situation, you're doing fairly well.
Actually, I'd never thought about that. Makes you realize if only doctors could do what he does, huh?
Well, in an automobile dealership, they like to give each mechanic a bay and a half. In other words, if you got two guys twisting wrenches, you want to have the bay between them empty because they're liable to get into something and won't have the parts available. You don't want them standing around for a day, day and a half, waiting for the parts to show up. Well, with Honda Bob going out to a customer, he has to come prepared or even come back and take a simple job and turn it into a career.
And but he never leaves you high and dry.
And still managed to do it within the amount he promised to get the job handled for.
Don, I'm gonna cut us off here, but I'll keep talking to you afterwards. But thank you very much for giving us your testimonial on Honda Bob. Well, that was really fun talking to Don. If you'd like to have the same kind of reliable work done on your Honda or Acura that only Honda Bob can bring you, and you're lucky enough to live in the LA or Orange County areas, give them a call at 562-531-2321, or heck, shoot them an email at hdabob@aol.com. Remember, HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide. And it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. Good morning, good afternoon, good night, Bart.
You left out good evening, which is the only right one.
I'm so time zone challenged. I just can't get this thing right.
Yeah, it's dinner time here, whereas you just finished your breakfast.
Yeah, yeah.
Madness.
We should get rid of that. Well, let's kick right in. I think we have some security light to go over.
Yes, the long, long, long awaited Java update has arrived. It does fix the problem, so it is safe to go and turn back on Java in your browser once you have it installed. But I have to say, if you haven't noticed any problem by having it off, I wouldn't bother. But you can if you like. It has not, however, been a completely clean update for many people. I suffered from this problem where it would simply say, update failed to install.
Well, I actually got it where it said, okay, I've got to go do this install. Let me reboot. It went off and it came back and then it ran software update and it said, you need to install this update. And it kept doing that. It took me like two or three reboots to get it done, as I recall.
Okay, in my case, technically it shouldn't need a reboot at all. The Java one, but you may have had lots of other updates coming through at the same time.
Maybe it was Safari, because I know Safari got 14 updates in the last 2 days, right?
He certainly got a fair few, yeah. But in my case, it came up, it said it failed, and so I rebooted the machine and then did it again, and it was fine. But in the way that only OS X can manage, whenever it fails to do an update, it downloads it again. And it was 150 megs.
There's your bandwidth.
I was not impressed.
Yeah. So to recap, this was the one that Sun had fixed quite a while back, and Microsoft had done the fix on their end, but Apple was quite delinquent, as I recall.
That's it. Apple insists on having a customized Java environment so that you have all your OS X-like buttons and things, which is nice. But if you do that, you also then have to take responsibility for maintaining your shiny version of Java, and they didn't do that very well.
And now, didn't the guy that discovered it, discovered the flaw, finally just go ahead and put out the vulnerability so to force Apple's hand?
Yeah, which seems to have worked.
Yeah.
I mean, generally speaking, responsible disclosure is better. But sometimes when the organization you're responsibly disclosing to is just being stupid about it, you take matters into your own hands.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. I'm not sure I disagree with what he did there.
On the one hand, I do. On the other hand, I don't, because at the end of the day, he got the problem fixed, but he got it fixed by putting everyone in danger. So, it's a morally very gray area.
Double-edged sword there, definitely. Well, anything else in Security Light?
Yes, this is sort of an interesting one. This is there was a URL shortening service got hacked so that the attackers were able to make any shortened URL point to whatever site they wanted.
Ooh, which service was it?
Now, it wasn't one of the famous ones. It was Kligs, so it wasn't Tiny URL or one of the ones that would be probably better known.
Mm-hmm.
But it was still one that would be used within social networking stuff. And, of course, our friend's Twitter is very much the kind of place where these things get used. On the one hand, URL shorteners are dangerous. They're really a security hazard. But on the other hand, if you're only allowed 140 characters, and with the modern fashion for URLs that are essays rather than URLs, I've seen many a URL that's longer than 140 characters.
Right.
So,
right.
How, you know, two into one won't go, as they say. So your only choice is to shorten your URL. But that introduces the fact that you have no idea what you're clicking on until you've clicked on it. And it introduces the idea that, well, you don't know what you're clicking on until you click on it is really the big problem. And then obviously the fact that these things could get hacked and you could end up going goodness knows where. So it's a pretty big target actually for bad guys.
Some of the clients will show you what this shortened URL, where it's going to take you first before you go.
Yeah, that's probably, I was thinking about how you could avoid this, and I think that's probably the only real answer is to have it be shortened, but then to have the translation done by your client before you click on anything.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think Nambu does that. Does Tweety?
I don't know. I don't use Tweety.
Oh, okay. What do you use?
I use Syrinx, and it doesn't.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. I sort of feel like I was the only one talking about this for a while. I don't remember, usually when I'm talking about something about security, it's because someone told me, like you told me to say it.
Well, myself and Donald had a discussion when you were away.
When I was away.
About this very topic, yes.
But I talked about it a long, 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 long time ago. I mean, when I first saw the shortened URLs, I looked at it and I went, well, wait a minute. Here we all are all being careful about not clicking on URLs and emails. I talked about it on the show. And yet nobody's talking about the fact that we're clicking on URLs like crazy on Twitter. And then right after that, everybody else started talking about it. Usually I'm a follower, but I think I noticed that right off the bat.
No, you're dead right, actually. And it is a big problem.
And we do. And you don't even have to give me much explanation for me to go, oh, I'll go click that.
Well, there's a trust relationship built up here.
Right.
Because you trust the people who you follow, but there's nothing to stop their accounts being compromised. I mean, we had Twitter hacks.
Right.
So once you have a trust relationship and the bad guy can jump themselves into a trust relationship, then
game's over.
You have a lot of people. Yeah, game's over. So in this case, the trust relationship can be broken by someone breaking Twitter or by someone breaking these URL shortening services like happened this time.
Right. So what's the lesson here? We're only supposed to talk about stuff we can fix. I suppose look for clients.
Remember to look in the URL bar after you've been redirected.
Oh, okay.
Just because it looks like eBay or whatever doesn't mean it is.
Okay. Yeah, I suppose you can do that before. But if it's one of these hacks that goes in and changes it so that you start sending out that URL, it may be too late for you by that time.
That's true if it's a cross-site scripting issue within Twitter that's being exploited, but Twitter need to stop those existing. You know, the only way to protect yourself from Twitter being badly written is to not use Twitter.
Yeah, and I'm not willing to do that.
No, neither am I. The crowdsourcing is quite powerful.
Definitely. All right, well, that's it for Security Light.
Yes.
So you got a new
to me.
in quotes back. And you had some topics to go along with that.
Well, we talked about the new Mac and a few things about it last time. But since then, I've obviously been using my new Mac, and I do what I always do. I did a clean install, and I thought it might be interesting, I think it's 2 weeks later now, to have a look at what applications I actually have gone ahead and installed.
Oh, yeah.
And it's quite a large number.
Because that tells you what's really important, right? We load all this glop on. What's actually taken the test that the next time you go, oh, cow, where is that?
Yeah, pretty much. That's how I did it. I didn't actually go and preemptively install stuff. I just installed it as I bumped into missing it.
Let me guess. I bet I know the first one. Firefox.
Actually, no, because the first three I sort of cheated on because I had the stack of Apple CDs there, so I just went through them all. So it's iWork, iLife, and Aperture.
Oh, okay.
I had the stack of CDs there, so I just fed them all in.
What could you do?
Then I went on to Evernote for some reason. Obviously, I had something in Evernote I needed to read out. So I did Evernote before Firefox.
Oh.
Evernote then went ahead and installed Growl all by itself.
Uh-oh.
I did ask.
Oh,
no, it
did
asked.
Ask, okay.
It was polite enough to ask, and I said, oh, okay, then that'll save me the trouble later. So that's done. Then Firefox, then Thunderbird, then Dropbox.
Back on Firefox, what about extensions and add-ons?
Ah, okay. But I always just copy my profile.
Oh, so you cheated. You brought over a bunch of glop then.
Yes and no. But I'm not, no, because especially for Firefox, when you're spent ages bookmarking everything you want and setting everything up the way you want, you don't really want to lose that.
Right. But as far as the add-ons, I mean, I got a bunch of add-ons. It's like, I don't use that. Firefox PDF plugin.
I actually call them from time to time.
Oh.
They slow Firefox down. And whenever I get grumpy, it's like, ah, Firefox has been sluggish. I go in there and I just delete a couple. I was like, go away.
I try, but they seem to keep coming back.
Don't install so many.
Well, I don't have that many. I have like 7, but I use like 2 of them. It's Flashblock and TreeStyle Tab, and that's about it. And Cool Iris.
Ah, yes, other ones, that's 3 there. Already.
There you go. Yeah, but
I still haven't talked
like
you into NoScript, but we'll keep trying.
No, you did talk me into NoScript, and I ran it for a while, and I hated every minute of it, and I had no way of telling when I should say yes or no, so it was just as bad as always saying yes, because I was always saying yes, except being irritated when I was saying yes. If I had some filtering capability in my own head that would tell me when to say yes, it would be useful, but I don't.
I only say yes if it doesn't work.
Right, which was everything.
Well, no, just because the bar comes up doesn't mean you have to click yes. if you can still read the site. So what if a bunch of ads haven't displayed because and it's saying, would you like to enable JavaScript? Just ignore it and read. It's only Web 2.0-y stuff that you need it because, well, it just sort of doesn't do anything.
All right. So what was After Effects for Thunderbird? Of course, you had to get that over there for your mail.
Exactly. Copied over profile again, which is always it's lovely how you can do that. Dropbox, because I suddenly realized I didn't have half my files because they're in Dropbox these days.
Good point.
At that point, I made it this far before actually installing the drivers for my keyboard.
Well, wait a minute. So your keyboard worked without it?
Oh, yeah, but the keys didn't match what was written on it because I have a UK keyboard.
Oh, that's
as
right.
As in a genuine UK keyboard, whereas Apple sell American keyboards in the UK and then call them UK keyboards.
Well, if it
so
says
if you
UK
actually
right
choose
on it.
UK,
If it says UK on it, that's UK then, right? If you put a sticker.
Yeah, but you would think that if you went up to the little drop-down and picked the UK flag or the Irish flag, you would get an actual UK or Irish keyboard, which are basically the same. Mm-hmm. But you don't. You get an American one because Apple sell only American keyboards.
Really?
Which is, well, yeah. I mean, they change a couple of the keys. Like, there might be a pound sign instead of a dollar sign. But it the shape of the keyboard is the American one, not the British one. So we
so
have
the key
a big
mapping?
Chunky enter key that goes over two lines and stuff like that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I think I remember you talking about this before.
Yeah, and our quotation marks are over the two and our at sign is over the comma, stuff like that.
Well, you should just change the way we do it then.
Yeah, but anyway, so I had to actually install those drivers because it did actually get to me after that. After a while, it's like,
okay.
I'm keeping, you know, every time I try to put something in quotation marks, it's like, at. It's like, what? Oh, shoot. And then I went on to making my desktop look pretty, so I installed DeskClicker so I could get all my nice Flickr pictures.
Oh, that's right.
Then I calibrated my monitor, so Spider 2 came on next. And only at that point did I decide I wanted to talk to other people. So then Adium came on, and my Twitter client. So Adium and Syrinx came on together.
Now, wait a minute. Now, why do you need to calibrate your monitor right then? Because isn't your monitor already calibrated from when it was hooked up to the other computer?
Well, no, because you don't. It's not the monitor that gets calibrated. It's the OS that gets
calibrated.
Oh,
the profile.
The monitor
that's right.
doesn't
that's
physically
right.
change, yeah. So when you say you calibrate the monitor, what you actually do is physically measure its profile using the photometer, basically, that the Spider device is. And that creates an ICC profile, which matches what your monitor really does, and then the OS uses that profile.
Wait a minute. You're saying the monitor doesn't really change. Then why do you have to wait for the monitor to heat up before you can measure it?
If it's so that not, you're measuring the monitor when it's heated up, not the monitor when it's cool?
I know, but you said the monitor doesn't change.
Well, no. When you calibrate the monitor, you're not actually calibrating the monitor. You're teaching the operating system how to work around the monitor's imperfections.
So why does it change then? Does the operating system somehow degrade over time?
Well, no, the monitor physically changes by heating up, which is why you do it when it's heated up.
Okay, but if you had it calibrated the day before you set it up, and then mm-hmm. you calibrate it the day after, it's because that that's because the new Mac doesn't know how to talk to the monitor.
But yeah, it's because there's a complete new operating system there, which knows nothing.
Got you. Okay, but a month from now, you said you're gonna you have to calibrate
you
it again.
To, yes.
So the monitor must be changing because the Mac OS is not changing.
Yeah, the monitor slowly changes its properties.
Okay.
Slowly over time. It's like any mechanical device.
Okay. I just thought you said it didn't. Okay. All right. Now I'll let you keep going. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, but sorry. No, what I thought you meant is the act of calibrating doesn't do anything to the monitor.
Okay. I got you.
So if I calibrate a monitor and then put it on a different computer, the monitor hasn't been affected by the calibration.
There we go.
If you get what I mean.
Yeah, I did have that backwards. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So then
you
Adium,
wanted to talk to people.
Yeah. So Adium again, took over the profile, which is nice and handy. Then Syrinx, which is new. I just decided I'd had enough of Adobe Air. I want real OS X integration. I wanted to use my keychain to store my password. I wanted to actually interact with real Growl instead of pretend Growl. And I just had enough of this whole Adobe Air carry-on. I want real apps. So I went for that because it was reviewed here on this very show.
There you go.
And it sounded good. So I gave it a go. I'm still using it, which means it passed the BART test. It's not perfect. It did die during the Twitchpocalypse.
Oh, yeah, we should talk about that at some point.
Yeah, I think, are we going to talk about Syrinx later anyway?
Yes, we are, so that'd be a good spot for that.
Okay. We'll leave it over till then.
Unless we blather too long.
Yeah, which is not impossible. Then I moved on to Transmit, because I had to FTP some stuff.
Oh, okay.
Then R-Sync, A-R-R-S-Y-N-C.
R-Sync.
Yeah, the piratey R-Sync. because I obviously wanted to do a backup, so stuck that on. The VLC, Parian, and Flip for Mac, those three together go with make videos work.
No, that's interesting. I don't think I reload those. Every once in a while, I need one of them, and I'll go get them. But in general, I'm pretty sure I don't have Flip for Mac on. What kind of stuff do you modify with it?
As soon as I bump into one video that doesn't play in what's that? OS X doohickey. I'm so bad at this. QuickTime. As soon as I bump into one, I just install those three, because then I don't have to worry about it ever again. So, that covers absolutely all your bases, those three.
So did you bump into one and that's what got you to do it? Or you just...
Yeah, I just bumped into one and I went, okay, right, time for those three.
Okay, so it was Flip for Mac. What else? VLC.
Parian is a big one, because that basically adds a whole bunch of plugins right into QuickTime, which is handy. Flip for Mac does the Windows Media File support, so WMV support. Mm-hmm. And then VLC for MKVs or sort of generic other stuff.
Whenever something won't play in QuickTime, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I prefer to do it in QuickTime. But VLC, I just sort of put on there anyway.
Yeah, VLC is just—it's just the best thing to have in the background for when everything doesn't work. It's always there for you.
Pretty much.
It's one of the first things I load on Windows.
Yeah. Yeah, VLC is cool. Yeah. It's nice and self-contained, and it's the same everywhere. So you can go to Linux and you have your VLC, and you can go to your Mac and you have your VLC. It's comforting.
Yeah.
Okay, so next is onto making stuff unzip properly, which is sort of again a glop of three I just put on together as soon as I bump into the issue once. Sometimes I come across zip files that just won't unarchive properly, and then the solution to that is a great freeware app called The Unarchiver.
Hmm.
Way more support than the built-in OS X has. Another very handy one is 7ZX, which gives 7-zip support.
Now, I put that on Windows, but I have never needed any utility to unzip a file on the Mac. I can't remember. I mean, but, you know, the old days with Stuffit Expander and that sort of thing, but in these days, never.
Yeah, I don't install Stuffit. I've gotten very grumpy with Stuffit because I find out that Stuffit are the reason I get spam constantly from Smith Micro. They have succeeded only in making sure I never give them a cent.
but I'm saying these days I don't install Stuffit and I don't install anything that I can think of unless somewhere along the line I brought Stuffit over with me.
Probably not. I doubt you would have somehow. But no, I regularly bump into zip files which won't unarchive properly. And TarGZ files, the OS X does it really annoyingly. Because you end up with a tar file and it does the GZ bit first and then does the tar bit and it leaves the intermediate file behind as a glop on your hard disk.
Like, yes.
Oh, come on.
That's true. I definitely get that.
Yeah, well, the unarchiver doesn't do that. It just says, oh, you'd like this extracted. Okay. And it does it.
Hey, I just checked, and I have Stuffit Expander on my hard drive that says it was last opened on Tuesday, June 16th, 2009. So apparently it's just running in the background for me. I thought it came with the OS.
No, it hasn't in years.
Huh. I got all kinds of Stuffits. I got Stuffit 10, Stuffit 12. I got Stuffit all over the place. All right, well, apparently I am using something.
Stuffit can go Stuffit as far as I'm concerned.
I don't remember getting an email from Smith Micro in ages. I think I remember used to getting it. But anyway, okay.
Yeah, I still get it almost weekly. And every time I get it, I hate Stuffit a little more.
But 7-zip on Windows is just crucial because it's the only thing you can, or the built-in stuff always expands it wherever it is. So if you expand that it turns out it's going to make a big folder full of glop, it all ends up in your downloads folder all mixed up with everything else.
Ugh.
So you have to use 7-zip. Have to.
Yeah, no, the thing I prefer 7ZX is it's a freeware app that that supports the 7-zip format on OS X, and it also much more coolly, you know, that the way that a lot of stuff that you, when you have a big file and you have to share it with people, you can't send it in one go because your email client will barf at you and say, I'm sorry,
right,
but I'm not dealing with anything bigger than 10 megs. So you break it up into .001, .002, .003, .004.
Right.
And then you have to put them all back together before you can unzip it.
Yeah.
7ZX takes the middle step out. It just sees the 001s and goes, oh, so you want me to join them and then unzip, and it just does it all in one go.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Good deal.
And even if it's a format it can't unzip, it will join them for you anyway. So maybe if it's a RAR file, it'll join them for you. And then you obviously need something else to unRAR the RAR, which brings us to the third one of the trio, which is unRARX, which is a free OS X client to unRAR RAR files.
You know, it's possible someone just tuning in right now would think that you're nuts You just said unrar the rar file with the rar file with this rar application. What are you talking about?
Yeah,
there
RAR
might be people
is,
who don't know what a rar is.
It's an alternate format of a zip. I don't even know what it stands for. But the AR probably stands for archive. And I have no idea what the R stands for.
Huh.
But there was a time when... actually, I'm not even sure if it's changed. But although you could theoretically put a password on a zip file, it actually was not proper encryption at all. And anyone, you know, it would take like 5 minutes to break the encryption. So if you actually genuinely wanted to securely transmit a file, you would RAR it, because RAR used actual proper cryptographic encryption.
Okay.
With the downside being, if you lost the key to a RAR file, it was gone. Whereas if you lost the key to a zip file, you downloaded a little utility from the net and it broke the encryption in no time.
Which would be a reason not to use it. Here, I just looked it up. It was RAR was developed by a Russian software engineer whose name was Eugene Rashal. And his name is Rashal, or the name of the tool is Rashal Archive.
Okay,
so
there we go.
R and Rashal and Archive. We'll never remember that.
No, but some dude whose name begins with an R. That much I'll remember.
It's also it's supposed to be a backronym for rational and reliable.
Ah, very good.
Go with
Which
that.
Is true. It is both of those things.
So where do you end up getting RAR files from? I don't ever get those either.
It just it depends on who the people are that you exchange stuff with. Because it all depends on who your contacts are, I guess. But within the people I will be dealing with, they don't like zips. They're just RAR people.
See, I don't really zip much here. I receive zips from people, but I don't zip anything. If it's big, I just...
Okay, so if you're collaborating on stuff, you wouldn't package up a bunch of related files and shoot them off?
Can't think of ever doing that. If I'm creating a lot of files, it's usually I would do it on the on a wiki or something. I don't write like in a... You know, like in Word or PowerPoint or anything, or anything like that, or text files. I don't create files.
Maybe
that
it's
I
more if you're building software and you actually need to send the whole load of glop together, because it takes a fair bit of stuff to build stuff.
Why not just put it in Dropbox? Working on it together.
It depends on the people you're interacting with.
Yeah.
If you're interacting with Dropbox people, then sure.
I make people bend to my will. If they want my stuff, they have to get Dropbox.
See, I'm not important enough to do that.
Right. All right, what's next on the list?
Okay, so that is the threesome there for making stuff not be small is 7ZX, UnRARX, and the UnArchiver. Then next up, I finally decided that it was about time I knew how much bandwidth I was using, so iStat menu went on. I love iStat menu. And so I can keep an eye on my temperatures and stuff. So that's just a must.
So that was the first of the menu bar apps then?
That was my first menu bar app.
Huh. I definitely
no, it
use
wasn't.
iStat.
Desliquor has a menu bar icon, so it was the second. But yeah, it's a good one. Then next is another grouping of two, which I have come to see as being so intertwined they're almost one, is Fluid App and Choosy.
Never heard of Choosy.
Okay, so Fluid lets you make specialized little web browsers for different things. So I have a Flickr one, I have I actually have one for our show notes. So I can command tab to our show notes, which is handy. But that's not entirely useful, because if you have a nice one for Flickr set up and then you click on a Flickr link in your email, it goes to Firefox, because Firefox is your default browser. So what's the point in having all of these custom browsers? So what Choosy lets you do is it lets you create rules. So Choosy becomes your default browser, and then you specify rules. And so you can say to Choosy that any URL beginning with www.flickr.com should be sent to this browser. Any URL beginning with something else should be sent to that browser. And any other URL goes to Firefox.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, because if you, like you say, if you've gone all the trouble, make sure you have this separate application, if you will, the separate application for Flickr, then it would be really dumb if it now just goes over and opens it in regular Firefox.
Like exactly. That, yeah? And in work, I use this very heavily because we have a web-based call logging system. And I really do want to keep that separate from my browser so that I can command tab to it easily.
Right.
But of course, it emails us whenever a new call comes in or a call's been updated. But with Choosy, I just click on the email and it jumps me into the special Fluid app I've set up for the call tracking system. So it really feels as if my call tracking system is a standalone app. But of course, it's not. It's just a Fluid app.
So Choosy is just where you define those rules.
So Choosy, it becomes your default browser. And then you tell it what browser to really use for different things.
So nothing actually opens in Choosy?
Yes, exactly. Choosy is sort of it delegates requests. So as far as the operating system is concerned, URLs go to Choosy, and then Choosy delegates them to different browsers.
So do you set something like Choosy? Do you put Choosy in your startup items so that it's always running?
It's a preference pane.
Oh, okay. Oh, I have to check.
And then you define the rules in there.
Okay.
It's pretty neat. Now it's in free beta at the moment, and everything about it gives me the impression that it's not going to be free afterwards. But for now, it's free.
Hmm.
And I will be buying it unless they charge extortionate prices, because it is an absolutely fantastic piece of software.
Sounds good. Okay.
Next up, we have Carl Quay, the IRC chat, and that was installed so that I could talk on the live show here over on Ustream.
That's right. That's right. Now, I always pronounced it.
Ustream doesn't work for me.
Colloquy.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like a colloquialism is apparently where it comes from. So colloquy. I don't know. C O L L O Q U Y.
Badly named.
Yeah, definitely badly named. It needs to roll off the tongue, and I have such trouble spelling it that usually Google has to tell me.
Yeah,
thankfully Google knows.
We've been less than enamored with Ustream lately.
Yeah, I've pretty much given up. Connor has a little embedded thing on a web page where I just get the video, and then I use Colloquy to just get the chat, and it just works, and I don't have to go anywhere near Ustream.
Okay, Connor did that, you said?
Yeah, he sent you emails about it, but
okay,
you didn't.
Yeah. Well, no, it's literally just a web page. Come on, those guys have a habit of sending me stuff in the chat while I'm talking. It's like, okay, I'm juggling like 174 things, and they're going, follow this link. I'm like, no, I'm in the middle of the show.
No, it was actually in the middle of the show, and I remember watching the conversation going, okay, Connor, wait afterwards.
She is not going to do that. I'm just wondering, because there's somebody who still can't get in. Is it Evan, who hadn't been able to get into the chat for a couple of weeks?
Oh, that explains why we haven't seen him.
Right, yeah, and he's really frustrated. So we need that information to get to him if we think of it. So that would make him happy. So we're going to try. I do still want to try to get into, what's the other one? Stick'em, but I can't figure out how to get, I can't find any buttons that say talk to my camera. So I'm stuck right now. I haven't been able to figure it out. I have to pay attention at some point and really crack that down.
One imagines that the people over in Ustream are at some point going to realize that their new interface is really buggy and really horrible and driving people away, and that they will fix it.
I hope so. And you know, imagine. From my end, I don't see any difference, so it's hard for me to tell what you guys are dealing with.
Well, it was just so buggy as to be unusable, so I stopped using it.
Oh, okay. All right, what's up next on the list?
Next on the list is one which we will be talking about again in a week or two, is Text Expander, since I now have a review copy of it and we'll have to review said software.
Great, great.
First impressions, though, I like it a lot. I like it a lot better than RepeatAllWrite, like a lot.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, I've converted back. I'm back on Text Expander. I started on Text Expander, went to RapidAllWrite for a long time, and now I'm back to Text Expander. Definitely a great tool. That's probably in my top 10, actually, because I can't stand typing out all this stuff.
Yeah, I need to have a tool like that, and it has for a while been RapidAllWrite, but it has been buggy for me, and it's just not as polished as Text Expander.
Yeah, I'm having trouble getting RapidAllWrite to stop. I'm trying to kill it, and I can't figure out how. Maybe we should talk about that offline, but I can't seem to get it to go away.
That's a problem I may be about to run into, because I'm going to switch all my machines to
Text Expander.
Text Expander, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that could be an issue if I can't make it go away.
Well, I'm just probably not paying attention.
Okay, we may have to work that one out together.
Good, good.
And then finally, number 27 on the list is Teleport. And I'm actually surprised I only installed Teleport yesterday.
Well, remind us what Teleport does.
It lets you teleport your mouse from one machine to another. So you have, in my case, I have my iMac in front of me, and I have my good ergonomic keyboard and my good mouse. And next to it is my laptop. And if I want to use my good keyboard and mouse on my laptop, what I do at Teleport is I set up the iMac as the server, and the laptop is a client, and then I literally move my mouse off the edge of the screen in one, and it appears in the other. And then the keyboard is connected to whatever computer the mouse is in.
You know, I played with that, and that's frightening. I mean, it totally does what you're saying, but it's like, how are you doing that? That does not make any sense. So you have two monitors, two computers, but one mouse and
keyboard.
Mouse. That's just, it's spooky. And you can even copy and paste between the computers.
Yes, it synchronizes the pasteboards, which means that it's actually as if you have a dual monitor setup.
How? It's like, it's
using
black magic. It's crazy talk.
Well, it's using underlying technology called Synergy that exists on Windows, Linux, and Mac.
That's right. Yeah, good point. You can do that and you can have a Linux machine, a Mac, and a Windows box and be flipping.
Not with Teleport.
Between them.
Oh, you can't? Teleport is OS 10 only.
Oh, okay. So you have to, but there's clients on the Synergy client on Windows is actually really good. It's much easier to set up than Synergy on the Mac. The last time I tried it.
Yeah, you couldn't use Teleport to Synergy, I don't believe, because Teleport expands on Synergy. It has Synergy as its base, but it's gone way beyond it.
Oh, okay.
So it's Mac only, but based off of the Synergy code.
Is Teleport free or is that paid for?
It is free.
Wow.
It's really nice. It's really well polished. And I'm almost, actually, to be honest, the reason I didn't install it for ages is because I use encryption over it, and I kept on expecting it to be troublesome because I was changing the server. But it just worked, so I really shouldn't have been worried about it.
Well, good. I do think it's pretty entertaining to figure out what are those things that you really do end up using.
Yes.
It makes you go back. So now that was 27 applications, you said?
That was 27 apps, and that's because it's on the iMac. If it was on the laptop, there would be some differences there. NetNews Wire wasn't mentioned here because I just keep that on my laptop. I don't actually put it on the iMac. So if I was doing the iMac, there would be different ones. Skype would obviously be in there. Cha-ching would be in there. You know, there'd be extra apps, but this is just what I'm using on the iMac.
So do you think you're stopping at 27, or this is just the first 27?
I think I'm done. Oh, I've been using it for 2 weeks now. I think I'm done.
Wow. And how many applications did you have loaded on the other machine, your previous Mac?
I had a lot more because there was a load of glop in there. You know, like yourself, you know, I'll give this a go, and I'll give this a go, and I'll give this a go. And, of course, they don't get used. So this is just what's left.
I'm just looking. Now, pull open your applications folder, though, because there's a lot of stuff that gets thrown into your applications folder beyond those 27. I have 251 items. Now, I know that includes, like, the utilities folder, but let's just do a delta.
I have 53 items, but my utilities folder is not collapsed. So if I expand my utilities folder, I have 76 items.
Well, that's not counting the utilities folder. So you have 53.
Okay, I'll collapse,
I have 200 more applications than what you have in there.
Okie dokie.
What are you talking about? I bring a lot of slop over. Actually, there is slop. I don't even think I ever did. I've got six separate Adobe applications, and none of them are anything I intentionally did. Adobe Stock Photo CS3. Actually, one of them is Adobe Photoshop Elements, but it throws in Adobe Bridge. Two different copies of, I don't know. There's a lot of crap in here. Well, you know, it is getting harder to do a clean install. You can do a completely clean install and then just bring your data over. But if you wanted to do like your user settings but not the application settings, it's a little harder to narrow it down than it used to be. I used to be able to do it a little cleaner, and now it seems to be all or nothing more to me.
I'm a nothing person. I don't actually ever use the migration assistant. I just click no thanks and then just set up my machine.
Oh, okay. Well, that should make it run snappy.
It is actually very snappy, but it is also G5 rather than G4 with 1.5 times as much RAM.
Hot dogs.
So that's probably why it's snappy.
And because you don't put 200 extra applications in there.
Yeah, but the applications, they're not going to slow your machine down because there's no registry. So unlike in Windows, just having them there doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
It just takes up hard disk space.
If I look, though, I end up with a lot of stuff that auto runs. You know, there's a lot of stuff in my startup items that I'm like, I don't remember telling you to do that. I mean, a lot of things. You know, iTunes throws things in. There's all kinds of stuff in there.
Okay, well, since mine's a fairly clean system, let's have a look at my startup items.
Because I know I was just looking at that the other day. So you get to that through system preferences.
Yeah, that's a good point. Oh, no, I was going to say there's loads of stuff in here. But that's because I always right-click on the stuff I want in the dock and say open at login. So they all go in there.
Okay.
So what have I got in here? Evernote Helper, Growl Helper, Stickies, which is one I told to start up. Desk Licker, it's one I told to start up. So I get my desktops changing from the start. Color Vision Startups, that's an entire thing in there for the sole purpose of checking whether a month has passed since I last calibrated my screen.
Okay.
I find that one annoying. Adium is in there because I told it to. Cyrix is in there because I told it to. iStat Menus is in there. Choosy is in there. Dropbox is in there. Text Expander is in there. And Teleport is in there.
So you have a lot in there. I end up with
it's
these
a clean
things.
System.
Well, like Growl Helper app. Does that have to run for Growl to run?
Yeah, otherwise there's no Growl.
Okay, well,
it's like the Growl server.
I've got Text Expander, Quicksilver, Caffeine, Dropbox, Sketch, Magical. All of those are on purpose. Surplus Meter Agent. I have no idea what that is. Shovebox, because I told it to. Media Central Launcher, which, by the way, I uninstalled yesterday. It's sitting in there.
Hit the minus button on that.
Yeah, but I uninstalled it, so I don't know how it's in there. Zoom 2, which is one of my favorite things. By the time anyone's listening to this, they've already heard me talk about it.
Okay.
Phone View Helper, which I'm probably going to uninstall because I did it just to review it, but it lets you load files onto your iPhone. But the problem with it is as soon as I plug my iPhone in, that opens instead of iTunes. So
that's what the helper's there for.
All I do is shut it off. So I think that just got gone. Oh, here we go. Google Desktop, which, by the way, I have also uninstalled. Let me delete that again.
Once Google gets its grubby little mitts into your system, it's not going away.
I'm telling you, I have definitely gotten rid of that several times now.
Yeah, but it has an automatic updating agent, which you can't get rid of, which is supposed to uninstall itself on next reboot when there's nothing left of Google's. But it doesn't seem to be too good at that.
No, I've thrown that away, and I'm throwing it away right now while we're talking about it.
I am exceedingly unimpressed with Google's carry-on. It's so Microsofty.
Yeah, that's about the meanest thing we could say.
It really is, actually, and I am very much pulling back from Google services. They've very much driven me away.
Let's see, Google Updater Ghost.app and Google Updater Ghost Installer.package. Gone. App Delete says, be gone with you.
Google Ghosts? I don't want any ghosts in the machine.
Exactly. It even required me to enter my password to get rid of it. I don't know what that was.
So it was in at a system level.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if it be gone this time.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we actually have one more little thing on the agenda. For some reason, I'm fascinated with your discussions about your keyboards. Sounds like a really dumb topic, but mice. That's right. Your mice and keyboards. So we have a mouse update.
I take it we're pushing Cyrinx out to next week, then?
Yeah. I think we're going to run out of time because we got the Mac Roundtable in 15 minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
Yes, I ended up with a new mouse completely by accident. Better Half got a new machine, but his old Microsoft keyboard and mouse were... Microsoft, I know. we're getting old and battered. Actually, it started to do this bizarre thing where even when you weren't touching the mouse, clicks would fire at random.
Oh.
So you'd end up randomly clicking on stuff when you were doing nothing, which is very annoying.
Yeah, that's handy.
Yeah, so we decided it was time that got binned. So we, went online and looked for the same mouse I have, because the mouse I had before was a nice mouse, the LX8. We reviewed it on the show here. But they didn't sell that anymore. So the only one they had was, what have I done with the bit of paper that had the name written on it? Oh, there it is. It is now an MX620 cordless laser mouse.
Cordless. I don't like cordless mice.
I don't like mice with tails. Clap off the tail.
Animal cruelty.
Yeah. But anyway, so we bought that for him. And there is something in his room. I blame the Microsoft keyboard, which was not replaced. It was only the mouse that was replaced. But it interferes with the Logitech mouse. And we thought the mouse was broken. So I said, okay, well, I bought it on my credit card. Give it to me for an evening. I'll just see what the problem is, and then I'll ring tech support tomorrow, because it's all in my name. And it worked perfectly.
So you took it?
Yeah. And then I said, okay, well, my mouse, I know my mouse works, so try my mouse in your machine. And it gave exactly the same issues.
Oh.
So it was obviously something interfering with whatever wavelength Logitech use.
Huh.
So we went back online again and bought a mouse with a tail.
I was going to say, those mice with tails, they don't have those problems. You plug them in, they just kind of work.
Yeah, so now I have a shiny new MX620, and I have to say, I liked my MX8. It was a nice mouse, but this thing is like super, super mouse. There's like lots of buttons and things. It's really cool. The first thing is the little dongle has become absolutely tiny now. It's the size of a USB plug. You know the way sort of the plug bit of USB where the cable starts? It's that size, which is great. So you just plug it in or forget about it. The ergonomics of the mouse are much nicer. It really, your hand sort of caresses it perfectly. It's very, very comfortable. The scroll wheel is this really weird thing. It has two modes. You can either have the old-fashioned mode where it's all clicky-clicky, so you have, you know, it goes in distinct increments, click, click, click.
Uh-huh.
Or you can turn that off, and it just it's literally completely free spinning.
Oh, that's
there is
neat.
No
you
resistance
have a choice.
To it.
That's really a smart idea, because there's people rabidly on both sides of that camp, right?
Yeah, I think I'd just become a rabid, no-clicky person. It is so free. It's got quite a bit of heft to it. It's a metal spinner, so it actually it's almost like a gyroscope or something. It actually has quite a bit of heft to it. So it actually has inertia, and so you can actually flick it ahead, and it will keep spinning. It's really nice.
Well,
but, like you
lovely.
Say, some people hate it.
Lovely.
And it's really nice rubbery feel to it. So it's a really solid metal spinny thing that has a nice bit of momentum to it and a nice rubber top on it so that you can really grip it easily so you can stop it in an instant when you see whatever you want go whizzing by. It's really nice. They've moved the extra buttons. So it actually has pretty much the same number of buttons as my last one, but it's moved them. So I used to have one on each side of my hand, whereas now there's two next to each other on this on your thumb. So two buttons right next to each other on where your thumb goes, which is actually quite nice. There's also a button with a magnifying glass that does nothing. But I imagine if I installed the drivers, it would.
Oh, but you don't believe in those drivers.
I do not believe in Logitech drivers. So I didn't install them, and it's working absolutely fine, even the spinny wheel.
So you don't notice any kind of lag with it at all?
Not at all. It is fantastically responsive.
Wow. That's the thing I had a problem with.
More responsive than the MX-8.
My all the ones I've tried, you move the mouse and a half a second later it goes, oh, sorry, I was sleeping. Dude, what, you want to move now? And then from then on it works, but if you stop moving it, it does it again.
I have not noticed anything like that with this mouse. It is really responsive.
It's not very expensive either, is it?
It's less than, I don't remember the exact price, but no. It's about
I was seeing numbers like,
50 euros. I think it was 40 euro or something, so 38, something like that.
Oh, I must have looked at the wrong site here. It says from $20.
It's possible. You guys often get much better prices than we do.
$27 at Amazon.
Maybe it's 28.
Yeah.
It might have been $28. But yeah, it's not a particularly expensive mouse, but it is a really nice mouse.
It's very pretty. All right, Bart, we better cut this off because we're late. We're late for the Mac Roundtable. We better get moving.
Okie dokie. I'm not exactly sure about the timing for next week, but we will sort something out. And until then, happy computing.
Well, I'm afraid that's going to wrap it up for this week. Be sure to keep all these great dumb questions coming, along with praise, suggestions, and just those saying hi emails. Write to me at allison@podfeet.com, and be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.